Of the House Energy Committee will now come to order. The time is 1:04 p.m. on Tuesday, April 1st. Members present are Representative Rauscher, Representative Tilton, Representative Costello, Representative Co-Chair Holland, and myself, Representative Mears. We have a quorum to conduct business. Brief at ease. We are back on the record. I'm just making sure I'm not getting an April Fool's joke here. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members to please silence their cell phones. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Errol Svedlik, and she'll take care of it. Importantly, I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, the House Energy Committee Secretary, and Emma Turner from the Juno LIO for tech teleconferencing support. The only item of business before the committee is HB 153, Utilities Renewable Portfolio Standard, by our co-chair, Representative Kai Holland, followed by invited testimony for the bill. Representative Holland, please introduce yourself. Staff join at the table, and please proceed with your bill presentation.
Wonderful. Thank you for the opportunity today, Chair, co-chair Mears, and the rest of the committee. For the record, my name is Kai Holland. I represent House District 9. House District 9 stretches from Basher and the Anchorage Hillside south to Girdwood and Whittier. It's a district that lives and breathes energy, home to the Kenai to Anchorage transmission line, a natural gas pipeline, and many of the workers and support industry business owners who keep Alaska powered. The legislation, House Bill 153, introduces a renewable portfolio standard, a policy tool designed to diversify our electricity mix and reduce long-term costs while creating new opportunity. It applies only to the Rail Belt grid, which powers over 75% of Alaskans from Fairbanks to Homer, while it also provides benefits to rural communities by controlling and reducing future Rail Belt energy costs and offering a revenue stream for PCE utilities to sell credits that do not reduce their PCE benefits. And I want to reemphasize this. This is a benefit to the rural communities in their ability to sell these credits without reducing their PCE benefits. Before diving into details, I want to say clearly that this bill does not shut down natural gas. It doesn't eliminate our power plants or obstruct a future gas pipeline. In fact, natural gas remains central to our energy future. What House Bill 153 does is position Alaska for investment, modernization, and stability in an increasingly uncertain global energy environment. Why now for this? We have so many other issues with our grid that we're working on. It's because our current path with 80% reliant on a single fuel source is increasingly risky and expensive. Rail Belt electricity rates have risen nearly 50% in the last decade, and the conversation that has already begun about importing gas is going to lead us to even greater volatility and higher prices for consumers and businesses. Instead, House Bill 153 offers a strategic direction. It sets modest targets for renewable energy, only 40% by 2030 and 55% by 2035. It creates certainty for investors, developers, and utilities. It reduces long-term fuel costs, with a recent NREL study showing that potential savings of $1.3 billion over the next 15 years from a 76% renewable scenario. And it sends a clear message that Alaska is open for innovation and growth. Many of you have heard me say before, it's time for us to build the future. This bill is the most practical, lowest cost, impactful economic development bill I've been able to work on this session. Let me emphasize, these are achievable targets in this bill. With projects already in the pipeline, wind and hydro, much of this progress is within reach if we stay the course and support a more diverse, competitive market. And combined with emerging tidal and geothermal projects, Renewables offer even more potential for powering large-scale new industries seeking renewable energy to power data centers, synthetic clean jet fuel, and hydrogen fuel exports. Alaska has long been engaged in considering clean energy in the Rail Belt's portfolio, starting in 2010 with a goal of 50% renewable and alternative energy by 2025 under Governor Palin, as well as bills in the previous legislatures targeting 80% renewable. Today, House Bill 153 reflects changes based on our understanding and the feedback we've received in the last couple of years. For example, this bill establishes a maximum requirement of just 55% renewable energy rather than 80%. Alaska has already shown we can do this. From Kotzebue to Cordova, rural communities have pioneered hybrid grids that integrated conventional fossil fuel generation systems with renewables and storage. In fact, we lead the nation in microgrid deployment and integration of renewables with conventional generation. Our challenge now is to bring those innovations to scale on the rail belt. We've also seen the evolution of technology. Battery systems, once seen as a liability for renewable energy systems, are now reducing the fuel use and improving reliability even for our gas and coal-powered generation systems. And the costs of solar, wind, and storage have dropped dramatically over the past decade. House Bill 153 is about building the kind of energy future that's resilient, affordable, and reliable. It reflects lessons from previous proposals, setting a realistic cap at 55%, including utility incentives and flexibility for compliance. It's a step forward, not a leap into the unknown. Members of the Energy Committee, we've heard from rural communities desperate to move off of diesel, from businesses held back by high rates, and from residents who want stable, affordable energy. House Bill 153 helps us answer that call, not by abandoning what works, but by investing in what's next. With that, I'd like to thank my staff, especially Shana Kilcoyne, for their work bringing this bill forward. I look forward to the hearing and your input in refining this policy with your insights and those of the industry and the public. And at this time, I'll turn over the presentation to Ms. Kilcoyne for a walkthrough of the bill and the sectional analysis. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to recognize that Representative Edgerman just joined us and Representative Fields has joined us in the audience. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Mears and members of the committee for allowing this presentation today. For the record, my name is Shana Kilcoyne. I'm staff to Representative Holland. Today, I'll provide an overview of the bill as well as a sectional analysis, and then we'll have two testifiers invited to speak. We'll hear testimony from Tom Atkinson with Kotzebue Electric about their efforts to integrate renewable energy into their grid, and Aaron McKittrick with an economic analysis of the bill, looking at where the existing projects in the pipeline should get us in relation to the targets and what could happen if no progress is made towards the targets, so really a worst-case scenario. Slide 2. This bill creates a Renewable Portfolio Standard, or RPS. It's a requirement on retail electric suppliers to supply a minimum amount of their generation, their retail load, with renewable energy sources. HB 153 sets the following targets of 40% by 2030 and 55% by 2035. This bill affects load-serving entities that are subject to the standards of an electric reliability organization, which is the Rail Belt Reliability Council, and I will not be using those acronyms today. I will do my best. This means it includes Golden Valley Electric Association, Matanuska Electric Association, Chugach Electric Association, Homer Electric Association, and the City of Seward. Henceforth, I'll refer to them as the Rail Belt or Rail Belt Utilities. This is where 75% of all electricity in Alaska is generated. Slide 3. For context, the Rail Belt utilities were at 15% renewable energy. This is from 2022. Really not much has changed, so we're still at 15% renewables. And I see the sliver that is not labeled. I apologize. That is about 1% for landfill gas. You can see in the chart on the right that as we start to import gas in a few short years, the price of gas is going to jump significantly. We are currently at under $8 per MCF or unit. New Cook Inlet gas contracts are going to start at $12.30 with the Fury contract. and imported gas cost projections range from $12 to $16 per unit. Fortunately, we'll start by importing small amounts of gas into our mix, but those costs are only expected to increase. Erin McKittrick will offer more of an economic analysis in her testimony today. As Representative Holland stated, the intent of this bill is to encourage energy independence, long-term cost reductions, and development of competitive markets. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory, or NREL, completed a study in 2024 that Representative Holland referenced, and that's for a 76% rail belt RPS scenario that would save a cumulative $1.3 billion over the next 15 years. This bill in front of us does not get us to that scenario. Slide 4. This is a map of existing energy standards. Green states have a renewable portfolio standards. Blue have a voluntary standard or target. And yellow are states and territories with expired energy standards or goals. Iowa was the first state to adopt a renewable portfolio standard. And I'll just note that Alaska is not listed, even though we have a goal, solely because it is not codified. But this is a showing that it's a fairly standard policy mechanism to give direction and market certainty, which every industry seeks. I was surprised to learn that over 90% of global capacity additions in 2024 was due to renewable energy and storage, and renewable energy and storage accounts for over 93% of planned growth in 2025 in the U.S. Slide 5, why is an RPS necessary? This policy creates market demand and a stable market that will attract new investment and create competition in large-scale renewable energy to reduce reliance on imported gas and lower energy costs for all of Alaskans. The bill is about fostering new energy economy to create jobs and economic opportunities for the next generation of Alaskans. In fact, many of our oil and gas workers are part of or seeking to be part of the clean energy industry. They're well-suited with transferable skills and knowledge. It offers incentives to maximize economies of scale, encourage collaboration, and leverage federal tax credits. Overall, the idea is to create an environment of growth and to leverage opportunities. Slide 6. What do we mean by renewable energy sources? Per the definition, this means a resource other than petroleum, nuclear, natural gas, or coal that naturally replenishes over a human and not a geological time frame. So we're talking about solar, water, wind, thermal, and it specifically includes waste-to-energy systems. Many renewable portfolio standards do not include hydropower. Ours does. Slide 7, carrots. This allows utilities to meet the target through renewable energy credits. Many of you have probably heard of RECs. These can be purchased from other rail belt utilities or PCE, power cost equalization communities, and I'll get to a little bit more details about how it affects power cost equalization communities later. There's a multiplier of 1.25 for wind projects that are over 100 megawatts that are installed before 2033 when energy is purchased by multiple utilities. And I think this section may look a bit arbitrary in the bill without context, but it acknowledges near-term projects that can be built now. It leverages federal tax incentives, and it fosters utility collaboration. There's a multiplier of 2 for distributed energy systems from small-scale sources like solar or wind or batteries to encourage consumer investment. This also allows for energy efficiency investments and distributed renewable energy systems that will reduce transmission impacts. Non-compliance penalties and waivers. I'm on slide 8 right now. Non-compliance fines of $45 per megawatt hour may be waived by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or RCA, if the utility has entered into a power purchase agreement before the next compliance period, begins receiving renewable electricity within 2 years of the prior compliance period, and files an estimate of purchased energy from that PPA with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, on this slide, and maybe the other. Through the chair. Thank you. I was just wondering if there is a non-compliance fine, Who picks up the tab besides the utility company?
The utility company, the fine is for the utility company to be
Would it be
clear.
The ratepayer?
Ultimately, the ratepayer would pay. And I think what this bill really works to do is have the waivers in place and fine alternatives that I'll talk about in a moment so that it doesn't go to a fine on the ratepayer. The idea is not to have a fine and a fund that goes to the general fund.
Okay, and one quick follow-up.
Follow-up?
On the page before that, purchase from the rail belt utilities, these energy credits, how does that work?
This allows flexibility. So, for example, through the chair, Representative Rauscher, this allows flexibility. So if there is, for example, a utility that is able to generate more renewable energy because they are all geographically relevant and wants to sell a REC to another utility that maybe is not quite ready to meet their target, they can do so. It provides a little more economic incentive, and that might allow them to still meet their fiduciary responsibility to their ratepayers while still collectively and collaboratively meeting the standard.
Okay, thank you. We can get into how that works later, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue, Ms. Kilcoyne.
For the record, Shana Kilcoyne, I am on slide 8. I am continuing on with waivers for the penalties. For reasons outside the reasonable control of the utility, including weather-related or natural disaster damage, or lower than expected energy generation, global pandemics, or acts of war. A waiver is also available or allowable due to transmission constraints that prevent delivery of renewable electricity from a third-party agreement or power purchase agreement. If the utility otherwise establishes good cause for noncompliance. And then I wanted to also generally point out that the waivers in this section is the longest section, and I think there are some very legitimate concerns about co-ops being fined for noncompliance. I'll reiterate that this policy is intended to help improve the environment and conditions for projects that the utilities are already working to implement, not to fine utilities. Slide 9. Continuing on to compliance alternatives, utilities may satisfy a fine by paying a customer all or a portion of the customer's cost of installing a distributed energy system or energy efficiency technology. Utilities may also avoid fines if they have met the first 40% target by using that fine amount for future renewable energy projects. This does allow exemptions if aggregate grid-wide renewable generation meets the overall standard. So if, again, one of the utilities is a little bit short and another utility has more than its target, so maybe 57 or 58% together in aggregate, then they will satisfy the target. Slide 10. Is differences from the previous RPS bill or HB 121. I know this slide is a bit busy, but there are three main differences I will point out. We've modified the targets, clipping the very near-term and long-term targets, and reduced the final target from 80% by 2040 to 55% by 2035. This bill, in HB 153, includes compliance multipliers that were not included in previous versions. And lastly, the fines have gone from $20 to $45 to align with the nation's average, though there are actually two ways to avoid those fines, which I just reviewed briefly in the previous slide. Renewable energy credits on slide 11. Renewable energy credits, or RECs, are a market-based instrument that represents the environmental or non-power attributes of renewable energy generation. RECs are issued when 1 megawatt hour of electricity is generated and delivered to the electricity grid from a renewable energy resource. Simply put, these are like a tradable pollution permit. Notionally, it's an economically efficient way to achieve goals, and they're meant to offer flexibility in this bill by creating a closed market.
Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, just a real quick question. Is rooftop solar a renewable energy source that could qualify?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, rooftop solar is a renewable energy resource that would qualify, and it would be eligible under distributed energy for a multiplier of two, because that is this is about incentivizing clean energy, and that energy allows consumers to invest their own money in that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
For the record, Shana Kilcoyne, I am on slide 11. Utilities would also be able to repurchase RECs to meet their targets. These could come from two sources: renewable power produced in the rail belt that was used by another utility but not counted towards their RPS goal, or from renewable power generated in a system serving a community receiving power cost equalization credits. This second provision is meant to encourage the development of renewable power outside the rail belt and to help lower the cost of power in those power cost equalization communities. Slide 12, power cost equalization components. This bill has two ways to benefit PCE communities. It allows PCE communities to build renewable energy projects and sell those RECs to those renewable energy credits to the rail belt communities for an added revenue stream. This excludes revenue from the sale of those RECs as well as recovered heat when calculating PCE so as not to negatively impact PCE payments. I'll note that recovered heat is not related to the RPS, but was added into the bill in a previous version from previous years, and so we kept it in. I'll also note that the PCE calculation is based on urban rates, so keeping rates affordable and stable on the rail belt will also affect PCE communities. If it pleases the committee, I will continue to the sectional analysis.
Thank you. Yes, please.
I am on slide 14, has a summary of the modifications in the bill. Slide 15, section 1 amends section 4205780, which governs integrated resource plans, commonly known as an IRP, for electric reliability organizations, requiring integrated resource plans to include options by which each load-serving entity may satisfy the renewable portfolio standard. Section 2 amends Section 4205-785A, which governs large energy facility project pre-approval, by stipulating that a public utility, which is part of an electric reliability organization, may not construct a large energy facility unless the Regulatory Commission of Alaska determines that the facility is not detrimental to a load-serving entity's ability to meet the renewable portfolio standard. Slide 16. Section 3 amends Section 4205785A, sub C, to establish an exception from the provisions of this pre-approval section for renewable energy projects that help a load-serving entity meet the renewable portfolio standard. I want to note that Section 7 repeals this exception on December 31st, 2030, which is after meeting the first target date. Section 4 adjusts the numbering of Section 4205-785 sub E and adds the definition for renewable energy resource within pre-approval for large energy facilities section. Slide 17. This adds a new article under Section 2, 4205, entitled Article 11A, Renewable Portfolio Standards. So the statute 4205-900 affects load-serving entities that are subject to the standards of an electric reliability organization which includes Chugach Electric Association, Golden Valley Electric Association, Matanuska Electric Association, Homer Electric Association, and the City of Seward. The section requires these load-serving entities to comply with the Renewable Portfolio Standard and requires those electric utilities to diversify their current generation portfolio by increasing the proportion of megawatt hours of renewable electricity generated or deemed generated that results in no less than 40% by the end of 2030 and 55% by the end of 2035. Slide 18, Section 4205-905 incentivizes the development of larger grid-scale wind energy projects that have greater economies of scale, takes maximal advantage of existing federal tax credits, and encourage utility partnerships. Incentivizes utilities to facilitate investments in energy efficiency and in renewable energy by their end-use customers. It further facilitates power cost equalization, or PCE, communities to install renewable energy generation by allowing those utilities to sell renewable energy credits to utilities that must meet the standard.
Thank you. And I believe we've got a question from Representative Costello.
Yes, thank you. On the previous section, Section 5, I was wondering how feasible these goals are and if there was any discussion with the utilities in when this was drafted?
Thank you. We believe that this is feasible. We drafted this based on feedback from previous versions of the bill, and we are speaking to utilities now. I will say that utilities, some of the feedback I've heard so far is that they might not be able to meet this goal, being very open with you, but also looking at the projects in the queue, I think that we not only can meet this goal, we are very close. We can definitely meet that 40% goal. We're very close to meeting the 55% goal. So it's not, from what I can see, much of a stretch goal at this point.
Follow up.
Thank you. Follow up.
And do you have an idea of what the cost would be to the utilities to reach these goals?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, that is something that I'd like to allow our testifier Erin McKittrick to dig into with her economic analysis using publicly available data, and then we can come back to questions from there.
Thank you.
If that is okay.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Real quick question. Do you have a percentage right now, a collective percentage of the rail belt right now, where they're at with renewables?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, they are at about 15% collectively.
Thank you. Please continue.
I think I'm on slide 19. For the record, Shana Kilcoyne, I believe I'm on slide 19. That's okay. 4205-910 governs the use of renewable energy credits. To qualify as part of a load-serving entity's portfolio, renewable energy credits must be generation connected to the same interconnected electric transmission network. Credits can also qualify if they are purchased from renewable sources within the service area of an electric utility that serves customers who receive PCE. I apologize, I already did this slide. Slide 20, Section 4205-915 establishes a non-compliance fine for a load-serving entity that fails to meet the RPS, set at $45 for every megawatt hour that the entity is below the standard. Each year, the $45 shall be escalated according to the Consumer Price Index. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska may waive non-compliance fines if it is determined that a load-serving entity has entered into a power purchase agreement for renewable electricity before the deadline and expects to receive the electricity no more than 2 years after the applicable deadline.
Thank you. You've got a question from Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you very much, through the chair. Real quick question now. The RPS has been played a couple of different sessions over and over, and I believe the last time it was reviewed by committees and modified through amendments, we ended up with a $20 because that's what the discussion ended up with, something that would suffice. I was wondering, why have you gone as high as 45 now with the penalties, and how does that fit into being able to suffice the ratepayers should they not make it? And then we're going to be the eventual payers to that in the end. And, of course, that will raise the amount of that we pay, which will offset less the amount for PCE on rural communities, so the, actually the subsidy will be less. So I'm just trying to figure out how this works out for PCE as well as us.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, this is a policy call, so 45 is what we chose to align with national averages, and mm-hmm. so if the committee determines that that is too high, they can suggest that. Did you want to add something? Yes, and again, I think the goal, of course, is not to put fines on consumers, and that's why the list of waivers and flexibility is included in here. Our goal is to reduce long-term costs through renewables, not put fines on consumers.
Thank you.
And if I can, through the chair, just follow up, again, Kai Holland. I just also want to note on this question from Representative Rauscher, the intent is that there is enough savings also being generated through the renewable projects and the progress being made, that if there is a shortfall creating a penalty in some area, that we've still made enough progress and saved enough money in the progress that was made, that there's still a net savings going on there. So you're right, that penalty is going to hit somebody in there, but we're looking at the aggregate benefit to the utility payers and the rail belt overall, and the intent is that this incentive is moving us towards lower cost or controlling the cost of energy that is greater than what this penalty might ever be. So this would never be a penalty that would be intended to add to the total cost. We should still be having saved money, even if we've got some utilities that are not quite to the goal and are paying this. But there's so many alternatives for utilities to never have to pay this waiver that it sits out there as a stick, if you will, but there's enough opportunities for somebody with the next 5 years to a goal that we expect everyone can meet easily, and 10 years to plan this, that there's really little chance that we should actually have to see anyone pay. But if we've gotten close, we will have already saved enough money that the ratepayers will have been far better off, and the PCE benefits will have benefited.
Quick follow-up statement. If we're 15% and we're headed to 40 by 30, that's 4.5 years before we start paying penalties. I'm just making a statement. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Costello.
Thank you. And I was just, and I, this may be something for the utilities, but it seems that if we're, the bill would pass, if the bill were to pass, it goes into effect July 1st, and then you're immediately dealing with this shortfall because the utilities haven't met this goal. What are the administrative costs that would come into play just trying to figure out the waivers that are going to be applied for and then having to file with the RCA, and then the RCA already is busy with all their dockets. So the delay there, I'm just wondering if there's been consideration of, you know, the administrative burden that would actually be on the utility to try to comply with all of the requirements of this legislation.
Thank you. I believe it's 2030 where the goals are set, but please answer.
Through the chair, Representative Costello, correct. They wouldn't be already behind because the first target is not until December 31st, 2030. And I imagine that if the utilities who are already working to implement many of these projects to that would meet these, if they have a setback, then yes, they would still have to go to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to explain that setback, and it would be, you know, one or two of the waivers. The burden would be on them to explain why they haven't met that this would be in 2031 at this point. And yes, they would absolutely have to go to the RCA. The RCA, I believe, understands that they can do this within their existing capacity. So I think they think they can fit it in.
We do also have several members from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska online if you'd like to pose that question.
Not to them, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the Chair, since we're talking about penalties, I guess my question is, and you're talking about some, the question regarding the administrative fees and what have you, that it would cost maybe to administrate it, but you're in talking about the penalties, which ultimately come from the ratepayer, where do they go? Where does the penalties go? What's the purpose for them?
Through the Chair, Representative Tilton, if I may wait, that's the next section allows some of the answer to that.
Please continue.
Shana Kilcoyne, for the record. I am still on slide 20. We'll wrap this up quickly and get to the question that many have. In regards to some of the waivers, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska may also waive noncompliance fines if it determines that a load-serving entity is unable to meet the renewable portfolio standard for reasons outside the reasonable control of the load-serving entity as set out in sub B, C, and E of this section, or the entity otherwise establishes good cause for noncompliance as set out in F of this section. Slide 21. And this, I think, gets to some of the concerns about the fine, because, again, the goal is not to have a fine paid that goes into the general fund. These are alternatives built in. Within 1 year after the Regulatory Commission of Alaska imposes a noncompliance fine, a load-serving entity may satisfy a fine by paying all or a portion of a customer's costs of installing a distributed energy system or an electrical energy efficiency technology. I'll pause there and explain that fine amount can go into distributed, meaning it could be a customer's solar, it could be energy efficiency, it could be wind, and they would have ways to do this in a way that is, they still have to meet their own standards for fairly offering benefits to consumers, so they'd still have to meet those standards. But the idea is that the fine could go back into the utility and their grid as opposed to being a fine that is paid to the state. Additionally, if a load-serving entity has met that first 40% threshold, then a fine that results from noncompliance of the second threshold of 55% may be avoided by instead depositing $45 for every megawatt hour that a load-serving entity is short into an RCA-approved account for use by the load-serving entity to defray the cost of future renewable electricity purchases or projects. Again, that fine amount could go back into the utility's grid portfolio. So back into the projects for that utility.
Thank you. Any further questions on this? We can always go back. Okay, that's it for the moment. Thank you. Please proceed with the presentation.
For the record, Shana Kilcoyne. Slide 22, section 4205-920. This establishes an exemption from the compliance with the RPS by individual load-serving entities if the aggregate generation of renewable electricity of all load-serving entities in an interconnected electric transmission network meets or exceeds the percentage required by the standard. So maybe not every utility meets it on its own, but as a whole, they have met the standard. Section 4205-925 provides for definitions used under Article 11A. Section 6 amends Section 4245-110A to exclude revenue from the sale of recovered heat or revenue from the sale of renewable energy credits when calculating power cost equalization. last slide, slide 23. Section 7 establishes a sunset by repeal of Section 4205-785C3, which provides an exception from the provisions of pre-approval for renewable energy projects that help a load-serving entity meet the renewable portfolio standard, which I did mention earlier when we talked about the exemptions. Exceptions, not exemptions. Section 8 establishes an effective date of July 1st, 2025. That concludes our presentation. We are happy to take questions.
Thank you. We do have some invited testimony, and I imagine there might be some robust questions during that as well. So are there any at this point?
Yeah. Representative Edgman? Not a question, but I just want to thank you for the great layout of the PowerPoint deck, and also the sectional analysis is quite easy to track and follow, and many times you sort of see them on a piece of paper, and they're fairly dense in terms of their readability, but I really just appreciate the layout.
Representative.
Thank you. It's a pretty involved bill, so walking through it, I think, was an important first step for our initial bill hearing. So at the moment, we'll be able to go back to questions here. We know where to find you guys. But let's go on to our invited testimony. First off, we'll start with Tom Atkinson, General Manager and CEO of Kotzebue Electric Association. Mr. Atkinson, please introduce yourself for the record, proceed with your presentation. Please let us know when to forward your slides as we go along. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. And thank you, committee members, for allowing me to testify on the proposed legislation in House Bill 153. My name is Tom Atkinson. I am the General Manager, CEO of the Kotzebue Electric Association. I have been asked to share briefly about the Kotzebue Electric Association's experience with the development of renewable energy over the past 25 years. And I will share my thoughts on the proposed legislation as an energy provider in my region. So if you can move to the next slide. KEA began development of wind energy in the late 90s with 50 kilowatt and 100 kilowatt wind turbines. Later in 2012, when we had a big leap forward with the installation of two 900 kilowatt wind turbines. In 2015, we added a 1 megawatt lithium ion battery, allowing us to store excess wind energy. Between 2020 and 2023, we added 1 megawatt of solar, making us the second largest solar farm in Alaska. We now have the capacity to generate up to 30% of our electricity from renewable energy sources. On slide three, the next slide, it shows a breakdown of our hybrid generation system, which consists of three 3-megawatt generators, three smaller generators, 1.4 megawatt, 1.1 megawatt, and the 725 kilowatt generator. Also the two aforementioned 900 kilowatt wind turbines, 1 megawatt of solar, and also the previously mentioned 1 megawatt lithium ion battery. We also have electric boilers installed in the hospital, National Park Service, and soon we will have a boiler installed at the City of Kotzebue Water Treatment Plant. This allows us to sell excess renewable energy at a discounted price, which is used to heat water to create heat for these buildings at a reduced cost. Having said that, we are still generating 70% of our electricity with volatile, costly foreign source diesel. Displacement of diesel has always been our goal with the development of renewable energy. With renewable energy, we displace 350,000 to 400,000 gallons of diesel annually that we used to have to burn to create the equivalent amount of electricity. Our goal is to be free of dependence on outside sources and to generate electricity for our community and to generate electricity for our community as much as possible. The next slide. This shows our 900 kilowatt wind turbines. In addition to that, we are working with the Native Village of Kotzebue, the tribal entity in our community. They are supported by ANTHC, and with funding from the EPA grant, they are installing two additional 1 megawatt wind turbines on our wind farm. We also have a grant from the Department of Energy for another 700 kilowatts of solar. The Native Village of Kotzebue will function as an independent power producer, and KEA will purchase the power from them. This will increase our renewable energy capacity to 50%. This will also further displace more diesel and keep more energy dollars in our community. On the next slide, this shows phase one and two of our solar development. Many have questioned have commented on the viability of solar in Alaska. I tell them wind and solar development together complement each other. During the dark, stormy months of winter, wind turbines perform better than solar. During beginning in March through October, solar performs better, making wind and solar combined the best opportunity to get consistent renewable energy throughout the year. On the next slide, having adequate battery storage is key to optimizing renewable energy. They allow you to store excess renewable energy when you cannot use all you are producing. And this allows you to use the stored energy during periods of peak demand instead of ramping up more diesel generation. KEA has received funding for two additional 4 megawatt batteries, which will allow us to displace even more diesel. On slide 8, one of the things I wanted to highlight was just the benefits of renewable energy. And it can reduce the cost of generating electricity by up to 50%. It is also far less costly to maintain renewable energy assets than fossil fuel generation assets. There is no emissions compliance for wind and solar. In 2024, compliance for our diesel generation cost KEA more than $50,000. It would have been even more without the use of renewable energy. Reduced energy costs for the community as excess renewable energy can be used for heating, charging EVs, and other forms of electrical beneficiation. As for my thoughts on House Bill 153, I do support it in principle. It is far past time that we address this issue. This is not something we want to continue to kick the can down the road and leave for the next generation to solve. To the extent that this bill forces us to have this discussion, it is invaluable. KEA chose the path of renewable energy to reduce our vulnerability to the volatility of diesel pricing and to create greater energy independence. We had no choice. The less expensive alternatives of hydro and natural gas were not and will not be available to us. Rail Belt utilities have had and continue to have more options, but those options are rapidly dwindling. It should be recognized that the development of wind, solar, and other intermittent renewable energy sources only solves part of the problem of meeting a growing demand. After 50% renewable energy is achieved through intermittent sources, a more consistent source is needed, such as hydrogen or small modular nuclear reactors. This technology is new and in some instances not commercially available yet. Diversification of sources is important to ensure that we can meet the demand and reduce our vulnerability to outside sources. I fully support a standard of at least 50% renewable energy. The question really is, how do we get to that? How do we do it? I believe the current bill in its current form is still more of a stick than a carrot. We need more input from rail belt cooperatives on this bill. From what I am hearing, there is more discussion on cooperative boards about this. They need to be given the chance to weigh in and express their concerns. It should be remembered that electrical cooperatives are member-owned, member-driven, nonprofit organizations. They are tasked with providing reliable, affordable power for their members. The percentage of renewable energy development in this bill and deadlines to complete them are very aggressive and most likely, at least in my opinion, not realistic. If the Rail Belt cooperatives are forced to make large capital investments to achieve these goals, they may have to pass those costs on to their members. If the Rail Belt increases their rates to do this, rates will also increase in rural Alaska due to PCE. While I appreciate the language in the bill broadens the use of PCE for recovery heat and provisions for the purchase of renewable energy credits for those Rail Belt cooperatives that are struggling to meet the standard, I worry it may not be enough to offset the aforementioned concerns. Having said this, I still support this bill going forward, understanding that there is still a lot of work to be done to make it viable for all stakeholders. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Atkinson. I really appreciate your presentation, particularly in this context today. I think Kotzebue is an example of, you know, what we are dealing with in the Rail Belt, and that solar and wind coupled with some other, on an integrated system. Even though solar is not providing all your electricity and wind's not providing all your electricity, they offset imported fuel, and you're able to utilize locally generated energy sources. So I think that's just a encapsulated a more complex system than we've got down here. So thank you for that. And then I see Representative Rauscher's got a question as well.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I just want to say that, yeah, I appreciate the presentation. I've been to Kotzebue a couple times, two or three, since I've been a legislator, and I've seen the operation firsthand. It's very impressive. But I do have a question on page 7, and I was wondering if I think it was like the third or fourth bullet point, ability of the battery will allow Kotzebue Electric to shut off the diesel generators when sufficient renewable power is available. And I was just wondering, is that quite often they're able to do that, or how often that actually may happen?
Thank you, Mr. Atkinson.
To the chair and Representative Rauscher, I would go ahead and be glad to compare our outage times to Anchorage anytime. We have very few outages out here, and when we do have them, they're really short-lived. But the batteries will be able to jump in, especially the addition of the 4-megawatt battery to increase our battery size to cover a larger period of time. But that's very important to resilience of a rural community that's not connected anywhere else to be able to have that type of resilience to renewable energy.
Mr. Atkinson, does your current system allow you to be off of diesel at all, or is that something that you're hoping for from the upcoming project, which is much larger with newer equipment?
To the chair, I believe you're asking if we can go diesels off.
Yes.
We have for a very short period of time. We just don't have a big enough battery until we get the batteries to increase that length of time.
But the new project, you'll be able to do that.
Yes. And I've got my engineers sitting in the room with me. Can you give me some type of an estimation with a 4-megawatt battery, how much time that will cover during an outage?
Approximately
2 to 3 hours. Yeah, 2 to 3 hours, which in a grid this small would certainly allow us plenty of time to fix the problem.
Excellent. So the battery storage is much more for evening things out and providing some backup rather than being able to purposefully turn the generators off for a significant period of time, at least with the current
plans. Again, our goal has always been to displace the amount of diesel that we're using. We've been very successful at that. We like to say when diesel comes north, our money goes south. So we want to make sure that we're using as little diesel as possible. Definitely having a battery allows us to do what they call load shaving, which is just taking the power from the battery during peak demand times instead of starting up another generator.
Thank you. I might steal that line. Are there further questions, Representative Rauscher?
No, I'm good, thank you.
Representative Costello?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I believe, you know, I've been to Cotsview too, and I think it's an amazing solution that you've come up with. What concerns me is that rather than mandating from the state level, I would like to see these conversations happening in the communities by the ratepayers themselves. And so could you talk to the committee about how it came about that you had this project and what motivated you? Because you are able to do this without state mandates, and I think that the conversations about renewables should be happening more at the ratepayer and the utility level rather than mandating with fines and that type of approach.
Thank you, Mr. Atkinson.
I couldn't agree more wholeheartedly. As a cooperative, as I said in my presentation, we're member-owned. The members go ahead and elect a 9-member board, which represents them, and everything that happens here is driven by the community. So I think that's a very important piece of that, at least locally here in Kotzebue. But I think, you know, what we're dealing with here today in the proposed legislation is in areas where there have been a whole lot more options than we have here, there has been an avoidance to talk about this issue. And my statement would be in support of this bill is the time for avoiding talking about this issue is over, and we need to go ahead and address this issue. So I would commend Representative Holland for putting this bill forth. I don't think it's perfect in this present state, and I think that we need to get stakeholders together and talk more about it, maybe even hear from our members as well, to make sure that everyone has a seat at the table before we implement something which may affect everybody. I would definitely be in support of this bill, with just some more work.
Thank you very much. Seeing no more questions around the table for you, thank you, Mr. Atkinson. Next, we will hear invited testimony from Erin McKittrick, MS. Ms. McKittrick, please introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed with your presentation. And the same as with the last presenter, please let us know when you can forward slides along.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Erin McKittrick. I'm an independent energy analyst based in Seldovia. I sit on the board of Homer Electric Association, but I do not represent APA, and I am speaking today on my own behalf. What I will present today is a preliminary independent analysis of this bill based on public data and published studies. Nobody paid me to do this work. Slide 2, please. And so what I was trying to address here is the first basic answer to two pretty key questions. One, can the rail belt actually meet the targets as are set out in this bill? And two, what would the economics be? What are the potential savings or costs to customers on the rail belt? Slide 3, please. So this shows past and present where rail belt generation is. So we have currently around 15% of our generation comes from renewable sources, mostly hydro. The rest is mostly gas with some coal and oil. And then the dotted line there shows the N2030 and N2035 targets as laid out in this renewable portfolio standard. Slide 4, please. So this shows one way these standards could be based on projects that have been extensively studied and could be available before the first timeline. So these are pretty much in the pipeline projects. And so there's three things listed here. The biggest and most important, that bottom slice of the green, is Alaska Renewables. Alaska Renewables is a company. Their two wind project proposals at Little Mount Susitna and Shovel Creek. So by themselves, these two wind projects would be enough to meet the first target. Then just above that, there's a small light green line modeled on the Puppy Dog Lake Solar Project. That particular contract was recently canceled, but I think that or a similar project is still viable. It's also the smallest piece here and doesn't really matter for the first target. Then the top band is the Dixon Diversion Hydro Project, which is the expansion of Bradley Lake Hydro through diverting more water into the lake and raising the dam, and the state through AEA has been pursuing this. So you can see that below that green line, there is a dashed gray line that says unadjusted. That would be the actual physical penetration of renewable energy under this scenario. The reason it's higher for the purposes of meeting the standard is because those wind projects would be eligible for the multiplier incentive that was mentioned earlier. So if you put all of these together, the rail belt would be about 2% short of the second target. Next slide. So this basically lays out the details of the projects I included in the graph. It is not the only way that these targets could be met, but there is a reason I chose these particular projects. They have been extensively studied. They could be available by the end of 2030. And their integration has been modeled into our current grid. So looking at that first project, there's a study called the E3 study that showed how if the rail belt utilities work together, that project could be integrated into our grid without major new transmission upgrades, meaning it wouldn't require things like the line across Cook Inlet or major increases in capability to transfer energy between the different pieces of the rail belt. The solar project, since it was based on a contract that had been signed by HEA, could clearly be integrated into the current grid. And the Dixon Diversion Project, AEA is working on it, and the energy from that is coming out of an existing power plant. It's just providing more water so that plant can run more often. Finally, I also did include distributed solar, like rooftop, you know, distributed energy such as rooftop solar in the graph, but the effect is too small to really notice. It's modeled here as increasing into the future at the same rate that it gets installed today. So again, that those wind projects would meet the first target on their own, then we would need to, by the second target date, add 2% more, around 80,000 more megawatt hours of energy. Next slide.
We have a question from Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, I was just wondering, you've mentioned Puppy Dog Lake. I believe the investors have pulled out of that project. Do you know why?
They said two things in the public. One is that their investors pulled out, and one was uncertainty over tax credits. I will get to tax credits later. Like I said before, that removing that project doesn't really affect what I've shown. Also, the contract for that project was very cheap energy, substantially cheaper than gas power is today. So if it was available at a somewhat higher price, it would still be quite a good idea, but it's quite possible that the developer couldn't make it at that price.
Thank you.
Quick follow-up. Yeah, I was just wondering, because if the idea is to produce it and it would have been such a cheap rate for us, I was just wondering why the investors bothered, why they pulled out. Was it that we were expectation was, and it ended up to be too expensive to provide something too cheap?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I can't speak to the internal financial details of that company or their funders, but the things that they publicly mentioned in their RCA filing was that the investor no longer saw that as a profitable choice for them, and uncertainty over the future of renewable energy tax credits was mentioned. There was no renegotiation at a different price, so it is not, can't currently know where that would have ended up if it had happened.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for paying attention to the public record and being able to share that with you. Please continue.
Yes. So slide six, please. So it's already been mentioned a number of times, and this, bringing it right up front, the possibility of buy. So I laid out earlier how these targets could be met. Now we'll go to what happens if they aren't met. So you heard there's this $45 per megawatt hour potential fine. And so this is pretty much showing the worst case scenario for fines. The rail belt utilities collect around $930 million from their members every year. That's the blue. And then the red is how much more they'd have to collect on top of it if they paid that fine based on our energy production today. And so that worst case would raise the total cost by about 5.5% in the first period or 8.5% in the second. Next slide, please.
Representative Rauscher has a question.
Yeah, real quick, thank you. The Houston solar project, we're told is 10% less power, 50% more expense, and I'm wondering, and then Fire Island didn't quite meet expectations, so I'm wondering, has that been figured out in your 5.5 to your 8.5?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, this does not, so two things there. Fire Island Wind is, you know, modeled into, you know, the amount of current renewable energy based on its past production. It's quite small, so taking it out would not really change our 15% very much. That's almost all hydro. The prices for both Fire Island and Houston Solar are set in contract, so their costs can't increase, though their production could certainly decrease, and I don't know the details of their production. This fines are based on just paying all the fines for the difference between 15% and 40%, or 15% and 55%. If Fire Island and Houston Solar did not exist, the difference would be tiny because they represent such a small portion of rail energy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Slide seven, please. So fines in a renewable portfolio standard act as a cost cap. They set the worst case scenario of what people could have to pay. But I think that really is a straw man scenario because it assumes a number of things. It assumes that no new renewable energy projects are developed at all, including ones like Dixon Diversion, which the state is pursuing. It assumes no contracts are signed for future projects because there's provisions in the bill that if the contract is signed, you know, ahead of time, even if the project itself is a little later, it can count. And that no utilities get a waiver for any reason. So they can't demonstrate to the RCA that they made any good faith efforts to comply, and there are no good reasons given that they couldn't meet the standard. And so bringing the actual numbers into it again, the absolute numbers here are big because the system is big. So if you look at that first potential fine, maximum potential fine, that's $51 million. And then if you interpret that instead in terms of consumer bills, you get to around a 1.2 cent rate increase for about $6 on an average household bill. So that's your kind of cost capture. And as was mentioned earlier, there are ways that those any potential fines can be used to help consumers with energy efficiency or save for future renewable projects. Any cost savings from those uses of fines are not calculated. Next slide, please. So more relevant than that straw man scenario of nobody attempting to comply, it's perhaps more interesting to look at what are the potential costs if we do comply. And obviously, there's some amount of that that's speculative. But first, I'm going to show you on the left-hand side of the graph some of our current sources of energy. So the very left there is natural gas. The dark red is the fuel cost. The somewhat lighter red at the bottom is the fixed cost. Our current natural gas plants cost us a little around 8 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, the new contracts bar there shows the price they'd produce power at if they were running gas on Fury's latest contract price. None of them are running on that gas entirely right now, but that shows you where even Cook Inlet is headed. Next, I put a couple of the other fuel plants, Ely Coal and North Pole Oil, up in the Fairbanks area. Our non-gas fossil fuel plants are generally substantially more expensive than our gas plants right now. And then I put several of our current renewable energy sources, Bradley Lake Hydro, Houston Solar, and Fire Island Wind. And to the question earlier, those prices are set in contracts with the utilities. So they will change only as they have escalation factors in the contracts. On the right side is trying to figure out what might happen in the future. All of these are set at likely ranges because we can't know exact costs. So first looking at imported LNG. So if we took our gas plants and ran them on LNG that's in the general projected cost range of $12 to $16 per 1,000 cubic feet, you can see that that's a lot more expensive than gas power is today and more expensive than all of our current renewable energy projects. And then Next to that, a short bar there is estimates of what some power purchase prices could be under our current tax credit scheme. So that is in federal law today. And then on the right are a series of bars that attempt to estimate what those might be if tax credits were to disappear. It's hard to do that exactly. I tried to be fairly pessimistic. In particular, the wind energy company that I mentioned earlier says that their projects are viable without tax credits, so perhaps on the cheaper end of that. And Dixon Diversion, I used the state's estimates directly. And so looking at that imported gas bar, you know, I mentioned earlier that the maximum potential cost impact of those first target fines would be around 1.2 cents per kilowatt hour. Those imported gas costs would raise rates 3 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour. Next slide. So this summarizes what was shown in the previous graph. Basically, future gas generation costs are expected to be substantially higher than today's. Other fuel-based generation costs are already high. With the current tax credits in place, future renewable projects will likely to continue to be cheaper than those imported gas projections, as all current renewable projects are. And if the tax credits end, the costs are likely to be more similar, overlapping ranges, but there are likely small savings available depending on the exact details of the particular projects. Next slide, please. So to summarize the current plans that the utilities are and the state are already pursuing will mostly satisfy the standard, meet the first one, and be just a couple percent shy of the next. A diversified grid may save us money over our other possible options, and any impacts the fines could have would be modest. I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Do we need a moment for things to percolate? For questions? Representative Rauscher?
I'm good, thanks. I appreciate it.
All righty. That's a lot for today. Ms. McKittrick, thank you so much for doing all that number crunching for us. And, you know, one of the challenges that we often have is just having publicly available data to work with, but I appreciate that you collect that and follow that and are able to share things with us. With that, are there any final comments, Representative Holland?
Thank you, Chair Mears. I really appreciate the work that's gone into this analysis and the preparation that Shane and staff has done on this, and the time to get this discussion started. You know, at the end of the material we've gone through today, I'm left with two basic thoughts. One is that the kind of projects that we see ahead here to me are an exciting example of the kinds of diversification, new businesses, new jobs that are going to be created by an energy sector, and the types of businesses that are being talked about here. And I think it was implicit, but I want to make it more explicit, that these projects, whatever we do in the future, are going to require significant capitalization, whether we're building fossil-based infrastructure or we're building renewable infrastructure. But when we're done, the renewable projects are essentially operated off of free fuel. Once we build the turbines and build the power plants, we're going to be able to see the benefits of that long term. So I'm excited about how we think differently about the fuel in the future and the cost of the projects. And I'm also reminded that as we look at the future, when we are having to particularly bring gas in from out of state, and I know there's a desire for us to use the in-state gas, but that's going to be a long time, that imported gas represents dollars that are going to flow out of our state. And the renewable projects allow us to keep more of the Alaskan dollars in our state and strengthen our local economy. And I think this renewable portfolio standard has been constructed in a way that has learned a lot from the last couple of years in terms of the incentives and how to use those in a practical way, and even how to modify the penalties in a way that they actually are putting the money back into future projects. So I'm encouraged with the work that's gone into this new version of the RPS, and I encourage folks to look at it with a lens that this is a new RPS. This is not a recycle of the same approach that was used before, given the changes to the structure of the incentives. And the work that we've done in this committee, to me, has really set the stage for this discussion, because we've seen over the last, 8 weeks or so, how important the relationship is between the urban rail belt power generation system and its relationship to our rural communities. We are tied together to some degree by PCE, but we're all tied together also by the knowledge and the skills that have been developed in rural communities that we can now bring into the urban solution. And this pathway is one that I think continues that connection and that benefit between the two. So I appreciate the time today, the questions. I know that we've got a lot of hard work ahead of us, but I do believe that this bill and its economic impact on the future of our state is, as I said at the beginning of my opening comments, the most important thing I'm working on, and I look forward to working with you on this.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, through the Chair, you know, because we've talked a lot about an RPS many years now. This isn't the first time. But what I'm wondering is, and I was going to make a motion, but I don't think I want to make a motion. I just want the committee to consider that maybe the House Energy Committee could request Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to authorize and fund an expedited preliminary feasibility and cost impact analysis and a comprehensive independent analysis of this bill by an unaffiliated third-party consultant. And I'll tell you why. It's the possibility that ratepayers will have to pay in the end should the fines not be levied to the utility companies. There's also a possibility that new programs without or new projects, I should say, with the Trump administration easing back, possibly, and I think it was mentioned in Aaron's report, that some of the incentives may be waning. Let's just use that word for now. And so the cost of these projects could go up, making the utility companies decide that they have to actually to fulfill the legal limits of this bill, have to act in a certain way. I think that maybe we should have the committee just think about what I'm asking. I'm not moving anything. I'm just saying it's a possibility that we should probably think about considering this action, because I'm worried. I'm a ratepayer. I have other facts and numbers that could say I could be end up paying $140 an extra a month in the end when all this is said and done. But it's my word against somebody else's word, against somebody's facts that I got from somewhere else, against other facts here in the room, somewhere, and whether we should consider this. And, you know, I don't need a yes or no today. I just want the committee members to think about possibility of going in that direction.
I appreciate that, Representative Rauscher. You've got certainly context along this. I have had some conversations that having an RPS, so the state kind of making a commitment to getting there with renewables, could also help make the investment in environment a little bit more favorable in the face of some other uncertainties. So removing barriers, we've done this with other energy sectors, having state policy making commitments to do things to make it more interesting and less of a risk for investors to invest in our projects as well, and that there are tangible and achievable projects in the near horizon. I think one of the things that we've been talking about all along is that the more diverse our energy sources are, the more reliable things are as well, so that we've got options, and we've got options that's beneficial for resilience in the long term. So any final questions or thoughts here today? Representative Costello, you look ready. All righty. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And this is more just a comment from myself. I appreciate this legislation here in front of us. I do question why we feel like the things are already happening, as Erin had showed us, where she feels like it's an achievable goal to reach, and those things are already happening out there on their own, then why do we feel like we need to put restrictions from the government out on the private sector to ensure that this is happening when it is already happening? So that it's more my own comment. I'm just not sure that it is our, you know, the place of government to put those kind of guidelines out there. So, thank you.
Yeah, just some of the things that they could consider in a third-party consultant ideology. They've got experience in utility-scale modeling, energy portfolio forecasting, ratepayer impact assessment, selected through a formal RFP process administered by OB&A, with a final report delivered in time to for us to make a final decision on the floor. In the meanwhile, we could still carry on our business here in committees. We could still vet this bill as we do. We can also understand contracts better, understand the responsibilities of the utility companies and all this. I'm not sure they've weighed in properly yet to anybody here. I'm just wondering whether all of that should be taken into consideration before we get too far anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I've been noticing that as much as we discuss things, once there's a bill on the table, then discussions all of a sudden get quite a bit more urgency. So I foresee work, not just from this conversation, but from other conversations and work that's being done with stakeholders to begin working on a committee substitute for it. So all the feedback folks have got, this is we have a big audience here today for this meeting. This is just a little bit of an indication that this is affects a lot of folks, and it's a pretty big deal. And so please reach out to the bill sponsor and myself as a committee co-chair to move forward and make this bill better. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, co-chair. I just want to, say, I appreciate the suggestion on the study that on one hand, I'm kind of drawn to the fact that this has been studied pretty substantially over the years with multiple NREL studies, ASEP studies, and other partners that have looked at it. So I think to some degree we can also go back and maybe do more to help kind of catalog what's already been done in the data that's there. And I also do understand that there is some current work going on to try and develop some of that analysis that you're looking for. So we'll try and come back on Thursday with an update on what has been done, what's already a resource of studying this issue and comparing the alternatives, but also what's in the works right now that might address some of your concern, and we can see if there's still some gaps or not.
Thank you. And with that, we will set the bill aside for further consideration. Yes, on Thursday, we have it back up to continue hearing House Bill 153. But we also learn how heat pumps can better integrate into our heating and energy landscape. There's been a lot of advancements there, and it's a really, I think, important discussion to have as well with implementation all throughout the state. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 2:34 p.m.